All right, moving on to item seven, which is a review of our total portfolio performance. Welcome, Scott and Mr. Price. I'll start. Do you want to start it off, or do you want to? All right. The floor is yours.
I just wanted to, as I usually do when we review performance, I just wanted to spend a little bit of time on the investment landscape, doing a market review. I'm waiting for the presentation to come up, but I make some introductory comments. So we've talked about this ongoing battle, tension between inflation and economic and earnings growth, and that battle continues with the big question mark about when the Fed is going to reduce rates or what the Fed is going to do with rates. At the start of the year, there was expectations that the Fed was easing us into a soft landing, and that there would be quite a few, up to six rate cuts throughout 2024. That expectation has come way back as inflation has remained stubbornly persistent, although it's been gone hand in glove with reasonably strong economic growth. So the market has continued to plug along and just seems to sort of on a daily basis move depending on whether the market views that inflation is going to win, growth is going to win, whether we're going to have, you know, growth with inflation, or there was even some talk about stagflation that bubbled up to the surface through April. But the market continues to sort of plug ahead, and we've just recently hit all-time highs across the main indexes. Recent data suggests that inflation is slowing, but the last print came in right sort of in line with expectations, slowing but not moving down to the Fed target that would indicate or cause a need for rate cuts. The big wild card continues to be artificial intelligence or AI, and that is a really interesting one, right? We've got the picks and shovels providers. NVIDIA's earnings are coming out today. I haven't seen the release, but people are spending a lot of time paying attention to NVIDIA as sort of the poster child for what's going on in AI. NVIDIA makes the chips that everybody needs to for the big companies are using NVIDIA chips to develop their AI solutions. And even so, NVIDIA and those big companies all are continue to move ahead on the promise of AI. You may recall, you know, these big technology booms happen slowly over time and get integrated into the broader economy slowly over time, what happened with the internet, but everybody's sort of betting that this is the real deal. And it very well may be, it's just a matter of when does the benefit filter down to the companies that are actually using AI to increase productivity. In fact, I heard some of your staff just talking about it earlier today about how AI is potentially going to be used here, and we're thinking about it a lot, and companies are just trying to look at it and see how they can use it to increase their productivity and profitability, but the market expects that it will come. So that's a big wild card in addition to inflation, growth, and what the Fed is going to do. I'll take you through just a few slides, starting on the U.S. economic summary. And so you can see here that growth continues. The most recent GDP print was 3% on an annualized basis as of the end of the first quarter. And GDP now is Atlanta Fed. They predict what's coming based on current timely economic data that comes in. They're predicting 3.6% over the next year, or over the next quarter on an average annualized basis, which is well above what economists are bringing in at about 2.1. But either one of those metrics just means sort of, you know, slow and steady continued growth. If you take your eyes down to the 10-year rate at 4.2% at the end of the quarter, that's been range bound really since then, a high of 4.7, a low of 4.3, and it's right about 4.4 today. So rates, so the 10-year rate is sort of reflecting where the market thinks the future of the economy is going, and it's been steady and range-bound. Unemployment continues to be, you know, employment continues to be a strong indicator that we're in a period of economic health today. It ticked up a little bit in April to 3.9%, but still a very strong indicator. On the next slide, interestingly, this is sort of gets to what I was talking about before, the market expectations of Fed rate cuts. So the blue line is what the market was thinking at the beginning of the year. You can see a pretty steep decline in number of rate cuts. And then as we've come forward in time, you can see that the market is expecting quite a few less rate cuts and ending up at a lower place at the end of the year. That golden triangle is where the Fed projection was at 4.6%. The market is thinking we're probably not going to get down to that level, but staying higher for longer. On the next slide, talking about inflation. So you can see on the lower right-hand portion of the page, monthly price movement. Inflation has been sticky, coming in at about, you know, the last couple of months were 0.4% per month. April came in at 0.3, so a little bit lower, but still sticky, and like I said, right in line with sort of expectations. Taking you back.
Did the Department of Labor drop all United States supermarkets and food outlets from their CPI basket? That's it.
I have not
flip
heard
comment,
that.
But the numbers seem inconsistent with what happens on the ground, is what I'm saying.
Oh, so, yeah. So CPI, so the things that are impacting CPI is really food prices were rising rapidly, but then they sort of leveled off. So, it was a big increase, and they're still expensive relative to what it was 2 or 3 years ago, but the growth in food prices has sort of leveled off. Rents have continued to rise, and that's a big part of what's keeping
it. Interesting. Yeah, I still see acceleration. It's anecdotal, of course, but I still see acceleration in the food area. At least that's been my experience.
Okay.
That rates could rise. To kind of take that last mile out of inflation. I know the markets had priced in six decreases that obviously didn't quite materialize.
Yeah. So there is certainly a chance, right? Mm-hmm. The expectation is that we're going to trend downward instead of upward. But I think, so the Fed has indicated its seriousness about bringing inflation down, and their credibility sort of depends on it. So if there was a spike in inflation that was expected to be persistent, I think the Fed would definitely consider a rise, but that's not the likely outcome.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for the question. Moving back a couple of pages to GDP growth, so you can see here where it came in the first quarter, and where the big impact is coming from, right? So growth currently is dependent on consumer spending. The consumer remains strong, sort of flying in the face of what's happening with consumer balance sheets and consumer fiscal strength. We'll talk about that in a moment. This is the point I wanted to make here, was that GDP Now forecast yesterday was at 3.6% on an annualized basis. So continued strong GDP growth supported by the consumer. Interestingly, for the consumer, you can see on this slide that, all that strength that was brought in by fiscal and monetary stimulus through COVID has really sort of tapered off. You can see the real spending on the left, the big decline during the front end of COVID, and then the big increase on the back end. Obviously, it's come down quite a bit, but you can see that trend line is still sort of trending upwards. And then you look at the chart on the right, and you see that relative to the personal savings rate, which is trending downwards. So the current consumer strength is sort of eating into consumer spending. And a big question is how will that be sustainable? So that sort of concludes my overview on the the economic landscape, but let's talk about markets just a little bit, and you'll see how this segues into your performance. I'll go back to domestic equity size and style that shows really where performance has been coming from. And this isn't going to surprise anybody. It's been those large cap, big giant tech companies, right? Large cap growth. You can see it on the chart on the right most easily, where the upper right hand portion of that reflects that Magnificent Seven, or I think what is now the Fantastic Four, given some underperformance of some of those names. But it really has driven the overall stock market performance. Large cap growth 39% over the last year. And then the two charts on the left show how sort of value and smaller cap companies have underperformed. If you look at the first chart on the left, value versus growth, that white line reflects when they're returning the same, and then when the blue line is below the white line, that shows growth outperforming value. And so you can see for some time, growth has outperformed value. And then similarly for small cap, you can see the chart in the middle shows how large cap has outperformed small cap when that blue line is below the white line. There's been this real headwind for a considerable amount of time for both value stocks and small cap stocks, and that's sort of counter to what you would expect over the longer term. But this trend that goes against historical trends has been consistent for quite some time. And then turning to equity valuations, you can see the U.S. relative to other parts of the world on the lower left-hand side of the page. U.S. Really expensive relative to the rest of the world. Now, that's seemingly for good reason. You can say that the U.S. has outperformed economically, certainly relative to the rest of the world. EM is largely dominated by China, which has underperformed for a period of time, and so those valuations in the U.S. Are expensive, sort of historically. But the big question is, you know, will that mean revert? And we don't know. That's why we have a diverse, well-diversified portfolio. It could be that the U.S. will underperform for the next 10 years. But for now, the U.S. is expensive relative to the U.S., and seemingly that outperformance is well-founded. And lastly, I'll take you back to the law of numbers chart, which is the last page of this section, and show you some of the trends that I've been talking about. So you can see here, if you take your eyes to the upper left-hand portion of the page, the domestic equity table, the 10-year column continues to tell the story that has been in place for some time. First of all, the S&P 500 at 13% per year on an average annualized basis over 10 years is pretty remarkable, given that the long-term average is somewhere between 9 and 10%. And then you trace your finger down that column to the Russell 1000 and Russell 2000. So that's the large cap, small cap bias there. Russell 1000, so outperforming by 5.1 percentage points per year on a 10-year average annualized basis is remarkable. Similarly, for growth and value, if you go down to the style index on that 10-year column, 16 versus 9, so a 7 percentage point tailwind for growth over value over a 10-year period. Again, pretty remarkable. And, big question is it sustainable, or are we going to see a pullback on that? And then similarly, I was talking about valuations between U.S. and the rest of the world. That 13 number in the S&P 500 row, going down, comparing that to the next table, the MSCI EAFE, three rows down, and the MSCI EM. So that's international developed and emerging market equities, 13 versus 4.8 or 2.9. You can see how the U.S. has really outperformed over the last 10 years. And then lastly on this page, I wanted to point out that on the right side of the page, the fixed income, upper right-hand portion of the page, that quarter-to-date number, you can see a lot of red in that column due to, sort of interest rate movements and changes up and down over the quarter, but largely slightly up. And so you see that duration in fixed income instruments leading to a negative return in some areas. And you also see that in the performances. Equities have surged ahead, and fixed income has sort of lagged behind. And with that, I'll pause before we get to performance. If there are any questions on the current.
Any questions for Scott?
Let me at least ask you to expand a little bit on what you see out there vis-a-vis value versus growth and this huge differential yeah. over all these years.
Yeah.
Likely to continue somewhat in the same vein, or?
So our research team has done a bit of work on this, and what they come up with is sort of sadly that they don't see any catalyst for it to revert, to take a bet on value. Counting on mean reversion, they just don't see any catalyst for it to revert. They also don't see any reason why it wouldn't. So, essentially, no position on whether value is going to retake its core position over growth. It's just it's cheap relative to growth, and then you have the historical trend relative to growth, but they're not seeing.
Did you have a comment?
Yeah, I was just going to I was up at NC PERS, and Lee Farage from State Street was given the economic outlook and said that the stickiest part of inflation was the cost of services. That was the highest part,
yep.
that food or goods had improved, actually, and that the economy was still too strong, quote unquote. And the labor market remained tight. However, the participation rate from 25 to 54-year-olds was very, very high mm-hmm. in the labor market. But the big problem was people who retired.
So we're attributing that improvement in the labor force and the labor participation rate as it seems to be there's a lot of in-migration now, higher than there was, and so that's leading to improvements in the labor force and the labor participation rate in that cohort. So there was this big retirement through COVID, and that sort of tapered off. And so that big drawdown in the labor participation rate is sort of reverted as
COVID. Yeah, and he did mention immigration also, because we have the problem with demographics. But a majority of the increased jobs that were created were taken or filled by immigrants. So immigration is a very critical issue to discuss at this time. And then he also said that the housing was anticipated that prices would continue to rise because of the shortage in units, like in the millions across the country. And he also said that he thought there was a 50% chance that we would have no cuts at all this year.
Hmm. Our team is talking about that too, and saying that that wouldn't be an unlikely scenario. Yeah.
Jay?
Yeah, sorry. So more of a general comment or question here. I just looking at the index returns over time, you noted the strong performance of equities. I'm wondering if you, just kind of from a larger perspective here, it's been a while that the plan's been using FFP, and I kind of feel like a situation where you buy insurance and never had to use it, and you look back and you're like, I didn't really need it, But at the same time, you look back at kind of the 10-year track, and you think about the opportunity cost. Of having that outside liquidity bucket. And I know you're all, you're kind of collaborating on strategic asset allocation going forward. And if you look at kind of the opportunity cost of having, an extra 5-7% of plan in short duration versus, say, global equity or even just the rest of the asset allocation, I'm penciling out like 30-40 basis points a year over 10 years. That's not cheap. So I'm just wondering going forward if you guys had any thoughts about, I didn't say you guys, but if you had any thoughts regarding kind of shrinking the liquidity bucket or looking at it from a different perspective in terms of net growth, and kind of changing the risk level of the asset allocation going forward that way.
I'll yield to Tim, but let me have some comments and thoughts on that as well.
Sure. I think whenever we're doing an asset liability study, we have to be absolutely objective on it and ask the question. And there's a look at using models, if you look at growth rate net, I think a look at varying, as we've done in the past, looking at varying levels of liquidity in the portfolio and try to shift that around. You are correct that there has been an opportunity cost. I think part of that is warranted given our funded status and having given a good strong funded status, we're in the protection mode. But you are right, there has been an opportunity cost on a looking back basis. I think on a looking forward basis, given where rates are today on the short duration, that opportunity cost is diminished. I think the other thing to kind of keep in the back of our minds is this open question of if stock market has beat everything else. The U.S. stock market has beat everything else. The U.S. tech has beat everything else. How long do we think that's sustainable? And it's one of those things that we build diversified portfolios because over time we expect mean reversion between these asset classes and going to be able to rebalance. We had a very unique period of recovery from the GFC, low interest rates, quantitative easing from the Federal Reserve, and then right as we tried to come out of quantitative easing, we got hit with COVID, and then zero interest rates, sharp recovery. The U.S. consumer has remained remarkably resilient. The U.S. tech sector has remained a remarkable leader. I do think that on a looking forward basis, there is a risk of that leader working. And so we always have to be aware of the opportunity cost of the insurance aspect of liquidity. But I would say in this particular environment, looking forward, I struggle with the question of how resilient the U.S. economy can be over the next 10 years, just given where valuations are. We've had a lot of earnings growth. We've had a lot of, it's remarkable if you take a look at the global equity index, so all countries put together, it is now 65% United States. That's up, I think, 12 or 13 percentage points over the past few years. You're getting this overwhelming exposure to the U.S. on a global basis. History would indicate that that does mean reverse, as not to be. But I think we kind of build this portfolio based on we're not there to pick. Focus solely on the winners and kind of pile into that. We're built for diversification. We're built for resilience, kind of regardless of market environment. And we've had a more defensive portfolio in the equity markets of the environment. And we have to acknowledge. So I think when we take a look at asset allocation, we will take a look at different flavors, gross versus net, different 2, 3, 4 years of benefit gains and reserves. But if we take a look, go back to 2020, what we were getting on corporation fixed income, it was now it's more like 5. So I think some of that opportunity cost on a go-forward basis is somewhat mitigated, but I think there'll be a robust discussion around that. I don't have a great answer for you right now, Jay, but I would say we're very cognizant that we built defense in the portfolio, didn't end up needing it, but we did protect our funded status throughout that process. I think that'll be a good, robust conversation.
I look forward to hearing it. I'm sure it's going to be a short meeting.
Well, we've socialized going to 2 years previously. I know I've mentioned it. It's been discussed here off and on, and I know that this is not the date and the time and the place for that discussion. But to your point, that's certainly an option, and it was an option originally, right? I think we had 2, 3, and 4 year horizons on the benefit payment bucket, and we initially opted to 4, went to 3, and now I think we're going to have a question about whether we go to 2. for all the reasons that have been said. So, coming up, right? Soon, I think. So, well, what's the horizon for that? Remind me.
Next month.
Well, that's coming up. That's all right.
So, just for my two cents, you know, I think your portfolio construction has served you well. It's helping you meet your vice objectives. And then, you know, I think about the insurance sort of metaphor, which is a good one, and I liken it to a situation that I've got going on at home right now. I'm having a conversation with my wife about whether we take off some of my life insurance, right? Because we're almost at a point, you know, we can self-insure and we don't need it anymore. But she is conservative and can sleep at night knowing that life insurance is in place. And so she, and I've totally left it up to her to make that decision, right? She wants to keep it, and so we're going to keep it because it helps her sleep at night and it is helping us meet our enterprise objective. So you just think about it from the insurance construct and what helps you as a board sleep at night and what's in line with your objectives.
We just want what you have, Scott, a happy life, because I think you're following the happy life.
You're right.
100%. Paradigm, if I've got it right.
There you go.
Be careful.
She does keep wanting me to go on these adventure alone without her, so I don't quite understand that. Food taster, I'm going to suggest that. Okay, so are we ready to move on to performance?
We are ready to move on to performance.
Let's go. So good news, good performance. We'll start with the on slide 56 in your packet. In the PDF, 50 on the hard copy version. So you can see the portfolio reconciliation here. You started with 11 billion net cash flow for the last 3 months, 120 million. Good net investment change, leaving you with a little over 11 billion at the end of the quarter. Similar, very same numbers year to date as we're into your first fiscal quarter. And then you can see that graphically at the bottom. So good investment returns for the quarter. Moving to a couple of pages down, just a, sort of a governance check here on page 58. And you can see liquidity is a little bit lower than your policy, but that's planned and expected as you get towards the end of your funding year, and that will be replenished at mid-year, and then it will start to trail down again from that policy level. On the next slide, couple of points here. So you may remember we had lots of discussion about that implementation benchmark. This is the first time that you're seeing it. And again, just to remind you, what this does is it allows you to compare your total policy return to how your policy is implemented, right? So the policy index is more near the market weights across asset classes, and the implementation benchmark is how your implementation varies from those policy weights. So this has a little bit more value, a little bit more small cap than your policy benchmark. You can see, as I talked about, that's why there's a headwind to those. That's why it's a little bit lower, a little bit more emerging markets, right? That's why it's lower than your policy index. For the quarter, your total fund beat your policy index and your implementation benchmark. We'll see in a second that was really due to good active management across most of your asset classes and most of your managers. And you exceeded your policy index by 70 basis points, 4.3% versus 3.6, and then 90 basis points versus your implementation benchmark. On the next slide, you can see, so I really like this chart. It gives you an idea of where it's coming from. And there's two places that it can really be coming from. How's your asset allocation relative to your policy? And how is your manager selection relative to your policy? So did the managers do well, and were you overweight or underweight in the places where it worked for you? You can see here that your selection was the driving force. Really, in the growth part of your the gross sleeve of your functionally focused portfolio. So your managers in your gross sleeve did well, contributing about 40 basis points of that 70 basis points for the quarter. But it was really across all the sleeves. You can see diversifying selection was good, liquidity selection was good, and then there was an allocation effect there as you were a little bit underweight relative to that policy for the reasons. Moving into some of the detail, so I'll look at gross of fees here just so we can see the universe rankings relative to other public funds greater than $1 billion. And as I mentioned, the biggest impact came from selection in growth. And you can see here domestic equity. So domestic equity was down 50 basis points relative to your policy. And that really is that largely that value bias and that small cap bias relative to that, to the benchmark there, the Russell 3000. But your active managers did well. So you can see moving down to emerging markets was a big contributor. So TT, your emerging markets manager, a manager that we were taking a look at and had some concern with for organizational changes, they actually came back strong in the quarter, 6.9% versus 2.4, and you can see that ranking in the 7th percentile. You know, it was really pretty extraordinary performance. Don't expect that type of performance on an ongoing basis, but glad to see that they are moving ahead and sort of overcoming any organizational challenges that they face.
I think that's because Tim went over there and talked to these guys.
Good job, Tim. Real estate as an asset class, continued to struggle, but you did see outperformance there. So it's the one sort of big negative as cap rates have continued to move up and been a headwind. And then, of course, we all know what's going on in office and the valuations there is continuing to cause problems in real estate. Your managers have outperformed in a really sort of dismal market. And that's largely because of your REIT exposure there, which has been performing better than your open-ended funds. And that's largely because of the low percentage in office and REIT. So it's, I think you have, in that REIT, I think you have something like 7% office versus in your Odyssey funds. It's come down from like 30% to 20 or below 20, but it's still relatively high relative to real estate.
Are you talking about percentage of value?
Percentage of, yes. So
I mean, as the value of the office has dropped, its presence percentage-wise is...
That's right.
We still have the same footprint. Right? It's not like the office has been sold off.
So there has been a little bit of that, but most of it, you're right, is a good point. Most of it is because of the decline in value.
Okay.
Yeah. And then in the diversifying portfolio, one point on risk parity. So risk parity actually, you know, we're 3% for the quarter is a, you know, pretty good, attractive return after, you know, some dismal and disappointing returns for quite some time. We're taking a hard look at risk parity as part of the asset allocation, asset liability review, and really thinking hard about whether that belongs in the portfolio. The diversifying portfolio up from the benchmark by 80 basis points. Contributors both in fixed income and multi-asset. CIT was the largest contributor there, and also they manage the biggest part of that portfolio, so good tailwind there. And then in liquidity, a modest amount of credit risk there was a tailwind, and that combined with active manager outperformance really helped that sleeve. So good performance across segments of the portfolio, good performance within each segment, and you know, no real problems to report this quarter. So all is well. Happy to bring you a positive report.
Well, thank you, Scott. Any questions or comments for Scott or Tim on the performance report?
Well, I'm happy that the benchmark seems to be working out, you know, reflecting more realistically.
Yeah.
You know, as a real comparable versus.
Hopefully there's some more informational value there, right? Just
right.
To show relative to the policy index, relative to the implementation index, you kind of get a sense of what you're doing in both perspectives.
Other comments or hands up? So thank you, Scott.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Price, the floor is yours.
I'm just going to go over the CIO report fairly quickly here. I think we've touched on some of the underlying themes in terms of it's been a weird decade. We've had a more defensive portfolio. And what I want to focus on kind of what the major drivers are from versus just a very simple target index. So I'll issue the blanket reminder as I do every time. This CIO report measures our implementation versus a simple target index. So if you buy the simplest version, each one of the three sub-portfolios, what would that look like? And that really tries to answer the question, has diversification paid off? And you'll see in some cases the answer is yes, in some cases the answer is no, but we can kind of get into the drivers there. So I'll take you to page three of the memo, the report card there. Three big things I want you to take away from this. Liquidity is working as expected. It's hitting all the metrics that we lay out here. It's also outperforming its index over the past 1, 3, and 5 year period. So we can have a conversation over the size of that portfolio, and we will have a conversation over the size of that portfolio come June, but the way it's implemented right now, it's delivered. Risk diversifying, we've had challenges. We've just made some changes there, both in the removal of Acadian Mars and the introduction of the BHTG systematic trading fund. So I'd say that one's a work in progress. I'm gonna set that aside. Growth is the bulk of our portfolio. It's, you know, 3/4 of the portfolio. Right? And this is where I want to talk a little bit more about diversification. So if we take a look at the trailing 5-year return of 8.4%, like, all right, the risk assets, 8.4% over pretty volatile environments and pretty unusual market environments, in the ballpark of what we would expect. Well, relative to that ACWI benchmark, that global equity benchmark, we're seeing that 260 basis point trailing rate. All right. What's going on? So the what's going on is on this page. So I want to spend just a minute here. Take a look at that top line where it says MSCI ACWI ND. You got a 1-year return of 23%, quite remarkable. You know, we all know it was a great year. 5-year return of 11% above expectations. 10-year return of 9% on the high end of expectations. Take a look down the rows there. Over the past year, there's only 4 strategies that have outperformed that global equity index. Over the past 5 years, there's 4 strategies that outperformed the global equity index. Over the trailing 10 years, 5. That doesn't look great. But what we have to remember here is we've had an environment where we have taken a look past 2 asset allocation studies and said, based upon where valuations are there better bets for the United States? And I think there was a conversation back in 2016 and again 2020 was the U.S. market was at tender valuations, non-U.S. markets were cheaper by comparison. We expected the mean reversions that were overweight for some of the non-U.S. markets and emerging markets. We had exposure to risk parity, which in theory works out nicely, in practice has not kind of panned out there. And so, you know, it looks like an alarming figure when you've only got a couple of things that have to come back global equity benchmark. So you look through and you just heard from Scott, like, okay, it looks like a good environment. The reality is, even though there's only 5 strategies outperforming the global equity benchmark, 13 of the 17 that are there on the 10-year number are outperforming their respective benchmark. So this is not a story of manager underperformance versus what they're supposed to be doing. This is a story of diversification not really panning out over this past decade. For all the reasons, and Jay, thank you for your question, for all the reasons of this being a really unique environment over the past decade, through a pandemic, through a global, you know, through the aftermath of a global financial crisis, through high inflation, equity markets have remained remarkably resilient, and it's been that focus on the U.S. tech megacap. And like I mentioned, U.S. exposure relative to global universe is just, it looks a little outsized relative to the whenever we see that, we tend to get a little bit nervous because we've seen this before in other markets. I mean, if you think back to Japan's exposure in the developed markets back in the 80s and 90s, I mean, it got up to 70% of that EVA benchmark before it came back dramatically. If you think back 6 years ago, China got up to close to 40% of the emerging market index before it came back. There is a history of mean reversions when something gets that large. And so I think this is a story of we have to be cognizant that if we're believing in mean reversion, this is a good chance to diversify. But boy, mean reversion is taking a lot longer. And this is a heavy topic of debate in the asset owner community of do we just not fight? Was it the Federal Reserve driving the market? Was it the consumer driving the market? What was going on? Or is it the role of passive indexing and the U.S. really active? There's not a great resolution on those questions, but I think the takeaway here is we need to have a conversation around the value of diversification and that we are built to be an all-weather portfolio, and this is not an all-weather market environment over the past 10 years. We had a lot of weird things happen. Equities, by far, took the cake over time.
So, question for you. For whatever reason, I have a much clearer recollection of the 2016 discussions we had, probably because it was such a fundamental shift in what we were doing. I have less of a recollection about the 2020 discussion. Did we have that asset allocation and performance discussion when we were at the bottom of the V?
This took place kind of over the course of 2020. I think we started right after we've just seen the March lows, and we started the conversation really in that April and May time frame, so immediate aftermath of the market lows.
Okay.
The board took the final action, I believe, in December 2020. So there was a elongated discussion.
Okay. Yeah. It's like it wasn't a single event or a discrete event. It seems to be different than it was in 2016 for me, because I have a better recollection of that for whatever reason.
COVID would be.
And COVID maybe, and we were probably on Zoom as well, right?
Yes, we were.
Yeah. Okay.
So I would say takeaway here is, you know, diversification didn't fully deliver on its promise. I will say what it did deliver on was risk reduction. So we didn't get the excess return generation we were expecting, but we did get the risk reduction. So if we take a look at this page, we take a look at that middle table where it's total fund performance versus simple target index, you'll see that we are lagging that simple target index over most of these time periods. If you go back down to the bottom line, or go to the middle line, you see the volatility is running significantly lower than the simple target index. And on a Sharpe ratio basis, over the 3, 5, and 10 year periods, we're matching or exceeding it. So while the diversification didn't pan out the way we expected it to within that growth portfolio, there was a risk reduction element there. We are delivering risk-adjusted returns. And that is that one type to the upside-downside capture. So I think the defense in the portfolio is working as expected. That's the red line there. That's the downside market capture. We're not capturing all, when the market is down or when the simple target index in this case is down over a three-year period, you know, we're capturing roughly 60% of those down legs. Not capturing the uplegs because of the more diversified growth portfolio there, and you've seen that blue line come down where we capture more of it as the market leadership became more and more concentrated in a smaller and smaller portion of the portfolio. We're not capturing as much of that, but I think this is something that's going to lead into our conversation in June around what's the right mix of non-U.S. assets given our experience. Past 10 years, given the forward outlook, you know, what makes sense for us looking forward. So I just want to queue this up for the conversation that's going to come.
So in terms of that conversation, I don't, as I've already said, I'm having a difficult time remembering the many facets of the 2020 discussion. Was there a summating document or sort of a recap or a final version of whatever the discussions and the consensus was in 2020?
There would have been a presentation from Verisk with the final mixes that would have been a board action to adopt and an investment resolution.
Okay. I think it would be useful for us to have the 2016 and the 2020 sort of final action piece included with any materials distributed. I mean, we all have them. We can find them. But, I mean, it'd be easier if we just had them, because I think it would be good to look at those snapshots, I guess, call them a snapshot, right, of that 16 and 20 going into this discussion so that we can get a feel for what the action piece looked like. And anyway, it would be helpful for me.
We can do that.
Tim, ideally, we want to see those lines far apart from each other, right? So we want to see our upside as high as possible and our downside as low as possible. And it looks like back in 2015, 2017, the downside capture was more favorable. So how do we improve trying to avoid catching the downside? And then the upside we're discussing, but also a question about that. We've gotten more and more into private equity over the years. And is there any impact of the J-curve phenomenon that might be affecting our upside capture? Are we realizing returns from our private equity at this time, or is that going to show up later?
That's a good question. There certainly is a J-curve effect in terms of the dollars deployed within private equity. I think the overall results of private equity have been positive. They have beaten that global benchmark over 10 years. We'll see the year-to-year variability of when the public equity markets run up a lot. Private equity won't catch up that year, but over 5 and 10 year periods, we are seeing the positive results there. We are still in build-out mode on private equity. We're not yet at our long-term target. We're getting more dollars deployed there. But we are, I think, based upon the last modeling, I'm trying to recall, it becomes self-funding in the next 2 to 3 years. We're not quite there yet. And of course, that depends on the private equity market function and perspective that the capital is deployed and capital is returning. We know there's been a hiatus of capital being returning. The equity markets being somewhat dislocated in 2022, and private markets really not coming back up to their full dissolution. Green shoots, but we're not fully back there yet. So there will be some more of a tailwind from private equity on a go-forward basis. We're not in full-on deployment mode, we're going to push maintenance mode. That's a good point. I would say with private credit, it's a similar story. It's performed well. But we are still slightly in expense mode. That's a shorter duration asset class, so we're getting closer to that one. We're getting much closer to the self-funding portion of that one. After the next 18 months or so, unless you change the target. But you know, these have been getting them built out, but they are performing.
Okay, and then follow up on the downside part. And maybe Scott can answer this also, but what's acceptable or what's the goal for downside capture? Is it like, well, if we're at 40%, that's ideal. I mean, you can't get down to zero. I know that for the upside capture, we want to be up at 100 if we can. But on the downside capture, with respect to floor and risk of loss and so forth, what would be reasonable and how do we get there?
So again, I'll yield to Tim first and then I'll.
Yeah, I don't know that there's a level so much as an expectation. I'd say, you know, given the portfolio construction of being more defensive than peers, we want to see that downside protection. You know, we want that insurance that we built into the portfolio to be manifested. And I'd say roughly around that 60% level is kind of in line with our expectations. You see that trough in, from 2015, 2017 as a bit of an anomaly. And because we didn't really have big downsides. Part of this is, you know, if you have a down market of 1% and you perform negative half percent, but that's amazing. So I'd say the defense is there. That 60% is roughly in line with our asset allocation expectation. It's the blue line, and the diversification not really planning out in equity markets is probably the bigger story here. And so I'd say, you know, if we can maintain a spread, I'm more worried about the spread than I am the level.
I want to pile on to that comment because it's an interesting one. You know, the old saying is if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And it seems to me that having a target or a performance expectation on the spread or the downside capture or the upside capture would be helpful as a measuring stick from where I sit. I mean, maybe we roughly have that in place, but it sounds like it would be useful to have more defined expectation in terms of what our policy is when we have this discussion and we just land on something.
Yeah.
And that way we can know. I mean, I know it would take a lot of time, but I'm looking at this chart, and you can probably take that point in September of 17, and if you, you could probably use AI, Scott. You could analyze that data, right, at a very granular level, and then try to chart that captured number with what was happening in the market relative to what our portfolio construction was. You could do, I mean, that's a lot of work, I realize, but so it would maybe help establish the benchmark, for lack of a better term, the benchmark number or range that we want to be in. I don't, David, if that makes sense to you, but that, to me, I would find that helpful.
I think we can probably take a look at what comes out of the asset liability study in terms of the kind of the neutral portfolio that the board defines in that process and kind of do some modeling around that. I don't want to commit to that right now because I kind of need to work through the math on it, but I think that's something we can do.
Okay. I mean, it's just my sense is it's desirable to have an expectation created for us, for you, for everyone about what the place we'd like to come out to, right?
Yeah,
which looks more like the 2015 spread than the 2024 spread.
Yes, and I think as we go through the asset liability study, we can kind of zero in on, is there another metric that is more illustrative? Is this the best metric? Is there another metric that's more illustrative? See what comes out of that. And certainly, this is a report meant to provide additional information to trustees around, is the overall asset allocation delivering what we expected it to deliver? And you know, I think there might be a couple of additional pieces that might illuminate that a bit more than what this is. Let's keep in mind we're building this deck out with 2016, 2017 technology. We have new systems in place now that we're testing out. I think we're going to be able to deliver you something that's a little bit more robust over the next 12 months.
Oh, that's great. But just as graphic is helpful, right? It, you know, the old picture tells you 1,000 words, and it's kind of it's helpful to see, right? In a very macro way, just what the trend lines are. Any other comments or thoughts on this? We done? Oh, is that it? We're wrapped.
That concludes my comments. Yeah.
All right. We are wrapped up. Thank you very much, Tim, and Scott. Second meeting in June?
You have to stick around with me for a few more minutes.
Yeah, no, I was just wanting to get the timing, for that, because I know we have item 8, which is the rebalancing. So, okay.